que se traducen en actos violentos.
We're giving them millions of dollars, $75 million we just gave.
Para reiterar sus argumentos sobre prioridades sesgadas, Joe Israeli apunta a los más de 75 millones de dólares que el gobierno estadounidense dio a los llamados rebeldes sirios, los mismos que se conocen con el nombre de Al-Qaeda. ¿En qué está pensando esta gente?, se pregunta la ex militar norteamericana.
I believe there's more to the story. I believe what we're hearing is something that
Riley señala que de seguro hay algo detrás de la violencia actual, y eso bien pueda estar relacionado con el deseo del gobierno de aprobar en Naciones Unidas un acuerdo sobre regulación de armas de fuego. Los conocedores del sistema financiero aseguran que todavía no ha explotado la burbuja de los derivados o deudas tóxicas de billones de dólares. La sequía en Estados Unidos amenaza las cosechas del primer productor de granos del mundo, y los frentes de guerra de Washington se multiplican. Todo eso ocurre al tiempo que los derechos humanos y civiles desaparecen, dejando en su lugar un gobierno más autoritario y más represivo.
The massacres and the executive orders make sense together along with the Patriot Act when you consider that it's all about control.
Riley subraya que las masacres que se suceden y las órdenes ejecutivas del presidente, junto con la aplicación del Acta Patriota, tienen mucho sentido cuando uno toma en cuenta que lo que se busca es más control. Después de disculparse anticipadamente, Joe Israeli señala enfáticamente que si alguien llega a tu casa a arrebatarte tu comida, tu familia o tu vida, más te vale que estés preparado para protegerte tú mismo, pues ya se hizo evidente en Aurora, Colorado, y en Oak Creek, Wisconsin, que la policía no va a defenderte. El almanaque de bolsillo 2013 de Radio Habana llevará la imagen del revolucionario cubano José Martí, que elaborara el célebre pintor ecuatoriano Oswaldo Guayasamín. Pedro Martínez tiene más detalles.
José Martí en el bolsillo del corazón. En más de una ocasión, el creador de la ciudad de La Habana, Eusebio Leal Spengler, ha dicho que los calendarios de Radio Habana Cuba se llevan en el bolsillo izquierdo, que es el del corazón. Y ya la emisora cubana de ondas cortas, con el apoyo de la ecuatoriana Fundación Guayasamín y la Asociación Española Cultura y Cooperación Internacional, tiene bien definida la imagen que llevará el almanaque de bolsillo de 2013, así como la fecha y el lugar para la presentación pública en La Habana de esta pequeña obra de arte. Se trata del José Martí, que aparece en el mural que el gran artista ecuatoriano Osvaldo Guayasamín realizó hace 30 años. El calendario será presentado en La Habana en la sede del Centro de Estudios Martianos, que acaba de cumplir sus primeros 35 años. La fecha seleccionada para la presentación del almanaque y la entrega de un reducido número de lienzografías con la imagen del más universal de los cubanos es la del 23 de octubre próximo, cuando se cumplirán 150 años de la primera carta de José Martí a su madre, doña Leonor Pérez. El calendario tendrá en la parte izquierda, con su firma, la célebre frase del apóstol: los niños son la esperanza del mundo. Las lienzografías serán entregadas en la capital cubana a los embajadores de los países que integran el ALBA, la Alianza Bolivariana de los Pueblos de Nuestra América. Un principio justo, desde el fondo de una cueva, puede más que un ejército. Reportó desde Radio Habana, Cuba, Pedro Martínez Pires.
Un alto oficial de la Organización de Estados Unidos visita la Nación Centroamericana de Honduras para investigar denuncias de violaciones a la libertad de expresión y de opinión. Benedicto García amplía la información.
El relator de las Naciones Unidas para la promoción, protección del derecho a la libertad de opinión y expresión, Fran LaRue, está de visita por nuestro país para recabar información sobre la existencia de las violaciones de derechos a la libertad de opinión y expresión, discriminación, amenazas y uso de violencia. Fran LaRue tiene previsto entrevistarse con Porfirio Lobo Sosa, presidente de nuestro país hondureño, y también con representantes de medios de comunicación, periodistas y organizaciones no gubernamentales relacionadas a la defensa y protección de la libertad de expresión y opinión. Recordemos también que Fran LaRue visitó nuestro país hondureño en agosto del 2009 y en su informe confirmó violaciones a la libertad de expresión y de opinión en nuestro país. Por otra parte, el sector magisterial de nuestro país ha realizado paros de labores desde finales del mes de julio y en lo que va de este mes de agosto, para realizar asambleas informativas y dar a conocer la problemática sobre los sueldos atrasados, sobre la ley fundamental del IMPREMA, la ley fundamental de educación, sobre matrícula gratis, el bono estudiantil, educación pública y los decretos de emergencia planteados por el ministro de Educación. Desde Radio Transparencia, en Nacaome Valle, Honduras, yo soy Benedicto García.
Afganistán, a pesar de que las cifras oficiales revelan una reducción en el número de víctimas de las tropas de ocupación lideradas por Estados Unidos, la población civil sigue pagando un precio muy alto por la intervención armada. Carlos Martínez reporta.
La violencia en Afganistán causó la muerte de 1.145 civiles e hirió a casi 2.000 de enero a junio de este año, según el informe semestral de la misión de asistencia de la ONU en ese país, UNAMA. Del total de muertos y heridos, el 30% eran mujeres o niños, detalla el estudio. La UNAMA indicó que el número de víctimas representa una disminución del 15% con respecto a la cifra registrada durante el mismo periodo de 2011. Sin embargo, subrayó que no deja de ser lamentable que los civiles paguen una cuota tan alta en el conflicto. Según los datos de la misión de la ONU, los grupos o elementos antigubernamentales fueron responsables del 80% de las muertes y lesiones de civiles durante la primera mitad del año. Carlos Martínez, Nueva York.
En África, la región del este de la República Democrática del Congo sigue siendo uno de los centros de muerte más grandes del continente. Emma Reverter tiene más detalles.
La secretaria general adjunta de la ONU para Asuntos Humanitarios, Valerie Amos, se encuentra en la República Democrática del Congo en una visita oficial que tiene el objetivo de llamar la atención mundial hacia el deterioro de la situación humanitaria en el este del país. La violencia en la provincia de Kivu del Norte ha causado el desplazamiento de unas 270.000 personas en las últimas semanas. Amos estuvo este miércoles en un campamento de desplazados de esa zona, donde habló con las familias y observó la distribución de alimentos y otros suministros de emergencia. La coordinadora de ayuda humanitaria se reunió el martes en Kinshasa con el primer ministro congoleño Agustín Matata Ponyo para discutir sobre la inseguridad en Kivu del Norte y las medidas que toma el gobierno para asistir a la población. Emma Reverter, Naciones Unidas, Nueva York.
Así concluye esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Agradecemos la colaboración de todas las personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
And next up on Free Radio Santa Cruz, it's Bathrop Spears Broadsides. Stay tuned.
Do you like to pull the band-aid quick or slow? Do you like to be the first or last to know? Is there someone you could phone so you won't be here alone as you learn about your future blow by blow? Did you ever have the feeling something's died? Did you ever notice nothing left inside? If I told you I was spent, would you wonder what it meant as we wander through the silence side by side? I could never tell what you were thinking. Maybe if we talked a little less and listened more, every day that passed I felt a sinking, deeper than I ever sank before. I'll be coming in the morning for my life, and I hope that you'll forgive the twisted knife. But when it comes right down to it, we just never really fit. And I wish you better luck with your next wife. You're a lovely boy, Doug, such a lovely boy. There's a lovely girl out there still waiting. You deserve some joy, Doug. You deserve some joy. You're a lovely boy, Doug. You're a lovely boy. Have you ever simply lost your appetite? Or thought of never coming home one night? That would really end it well. It's a story you could sell. And you could finally tell your mother she was right. You're a lovely boy, Doug. Such a lovely boy. There's a lovely girl on the horizon. There's a world to join, Doug. There's a world to join.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show.
You're a lovely boy, Doug. You're a lovely boy. There is nothing I can say to ease your burden. I was never one for crocodile tears. And I would leave you everything to store your hurting. And they'll give you alimony for at least a couple years. You're a lovely boy, Duck. Such a lovely boy. I was not as lovely as you needed. And I filled the void, Doug. I just filled the void. You're a lovely boy, Doug. You're a lovely boy. Do you like to pull the band-aid quick or slow? Do you like to be the first or last to know? You were such a gentle touch. And you gave away so much. I never thought about the undertow. But I always knew I'd be the first to go.
Yeah, that was Uncle Banzai, one of my new favorites, a group I've been playing on and off on this show for 20 years almost now. But that's a fairly new DVD or CD, actually, for those who are old-time listeners. So it's called Doug's Divorce. You're tuned to Free Radio 101.3 FM, also known as Freak Radio. We are not at freakradio.org anymore, but if you go to the TuneIn on your browser, you'll catch the proper, rather lengthy stream. We can be found at the address is rather lengthy. And the name of this show is Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I'll be here for the next 2 hours. And we're going to begin the show by talking about... talking hopefully very little and letting someone else do the talking. Daniel Ellsberg. Had an interview with an activist about the issues around Nagasaki, because today, of course, is Nagasaki Day. Back in 1945, the U.S. military obliterated a second Japanese city with an atomic bomb on the orders of President Harry S. Truman. Who knows what the S stands for? Some would say shithead. I wouldn't call it that. But a lot of soldiers, including my father, were very grateful that the war ended. I, of course, looking back, regard the president as a war criminal. And I regard anyone who uses these weapons against civilians or even military people as war criminals. And it's an issue that Daniel Ellsberg raised, of course, in the Vietnam War with his exposure of the Pentagon Papers, come up more recently with WikiLeaks and the attacks on Julian Assange and Bradley Manning. I thought this would be appropriate to begin the show. The call-in number here, in case you want to give me some updates, comments, your own thoughts, is 427-3772, 427-3772. You can reach me off-air at 423-HUFF, 423-HUFF, acronym for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, a group that kind of stumbles along but has been instrumental in the years in raising issues that I think other groups are reluctant to talk about, namely homeless civil rights or lack of civil rights in Santa Cruz. And I'll be continuing in that tradition today, raising those issues again and talking about what's going on around that. I guess you could say the Nagasaki bomb left a lot of people not just homeless, but bodiless, relativeless, and all kinds of other lesses. Anyway, let's listen to a little bit of this. Scott Horton interviewing Daniel Ellsberg about Nagasaki and nuclear weapons and that sort of thing.
Accomplishments. He's also the author of the book Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers. And then there's a new one about the nuclear war issue, which I believe is coming out soon, but is not finished yet. Is that correct, Dan? Welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be back. No, it's not very soon. It's due in January. It's called The American Doomsday Machine.
Right.
Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner, which is what I was 40 years ago, 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that? What's it like to plan a nuclear war?
Well, in the 80s, I was in the late 50s and early 60s, I was in the belief that there was a missile gap in favor of the Soviets. That's just what the intelligence estimates said, that they were on a crash effort to develop an ability for a surprise attack against the U.S. or a major threat against the U.S. So what I was helping plan was to assure them that if they did that, there would be retaliation, that they couldn't do that without being destroyed themselves, and thus we hope to deter them from doing that. Now, in actual fact, that was like deterring Saddam Hussein from using his nuclear weapons in 2003. He didn't have any. He didn't have a program and hadn't had for virtually a decade. The same virtually was true of the Soviets. They did have a nuclear program, but at a time when we had thousands of nuclear weapons poised to attack them and a tremendous number that were ready to deal with any surprise attack by them, they had no ability for a surprise attack against us. They had exactly four missiles in 1960 and 61, 61 being the year of the Berlin crisis, a time when Kennedy was asking the nation to build home fallout shelters, led to a fallout shelter craze in case there was an attack by the Soviet Union with their four ICBMs. So it was a totally illusory situation. I felt, you ask what it felt like, well, it felt desperate to keep them from using their illusory nuclear weapons. Just as, by the way, we're being told right now that we're in a desperate race to keep the Iranians from getting a nuclear weapon, whereas actually there is no evidence whatever that they're seeking a nuclear weapon.
Now, I got to ask you, Dan, I know that around the time of the whole controversy with the Pentagon Papers, you had a lot of new leaves to turn over, and you did, but I'm curious as to how you ever could have become a nuclear war planner in the first place when you were one of the few Americans who knew, who understood about nuclear weapons before they were actually used, and who, as you write in your article at truthdig.com, Hiroshima Day, you knew better. You disagreed with the decision to use nuclear weapons against the Japanese. How did you ever even get into that position?
I think I answered that in answer to your first question, Scott, if you think about it for a moment. I definitely had learned I was a very dubious and skeptical of the wisdom of and rightness of using a nuclear weapon against Japan in 1945, because I'd been studying what the implications of that were for the future, it so happens, having in a piece I take it you've read that's on my archive, Ellsberg.net, did realize that there would be a U-235 bomb and that would open an arms race that would have very sinister implications for humanity. After that, Within the next decade or so, I had learned that we'd been totally misled about the occasion for using the atom bomb at Hiroshima, that the reasons given for it, which purported to justify it, were entirely falsified. And that's another story. So that lends weight to your question, even, how could I possibly have gotten involved? And the answer was that whereas Japan, we knew, was a non-nuclear nation that we were using an atom bomb against, Soviet Union, we were led to believe at the RAND Corporation by top-secret intelligence estimates, was not only a nuclear nation, which meant that it would be, it seemed like insanity to initiate nuclear war against them, was a nation that might, we were told, initiate war against us, and that the only way of stopping that in the world was to assure them of retaliation.
Right.
If that had been true, that they were in a crash effort to achieve that capability against us and might use it in a surprise attack, and were like Hitler, that was the Cold War psychology of the time, that they could not be negotiated with, they could not be stayed in any form by any concessions or agreement or inspection from launching this surprise attack like Hitler, had that been true, then I would have to say even now, it would be hard to say that one should not develop a retaliatory capability. I can't say, for example, that the Soviet Union or China were wrong to although the long-run effects on the arms race are very ominous, but I can't say they were wrong to develop a deterrent retaliatory capability against the U.S. Mm-hmm. And had the Soviets been in this superior position in 58, 59, which our intelligence people believe they were, I think that a retaliatory capability had to be developed. Of course, the reality was that our top military people really knew those intelligence estimates were false, as the Army and Navy had been saying, against the Air Force for a couple of years by that time. And knowing that, the plans I was working on were actually relevant only to a U.S. first strike, as in a war developing in Europe or over Berlin, where we might have struck first in escalation of that war. There was no chance whatever of the Soviets launching an attack on us any more than Saddam could have launched an attack on us in either 91 or 2003. But our leaders, and in that both Republican and Democrat, misled us on that point.
Mm-hmm. Well, a couple of real big misleadings there that need addressing. I guess, well, I'll save the Hiroshima question until after we get back from the next break. But can you talk about, you know, what you're alluding to there? I believe what you're trying to say is that they knew that it wasn't true, what they had told you, that the Soviets, that there was this missile gap and that they were way ahead and that we need all our Dan Ellsbergs to help us make more and better hydrogen bombs to defend ourselves from the Russians. They knew that wasn't really right. Is that what you're saying?
Well, yes and no. I think that in 58, when the word of the missile gap first arose in a strong way in the intelligence community, that was 1 year after the Soviets had put up Sputnik, which we weren't yet able to do, and had launched an ICBM, which we weren't yet able to do. So they did seem to be ahead of us in developing these weapons. And in 58, I think the projection that they would develop a lot of weapons before we had them was probably sincerely helped by people who were in the grip of the Cold War ideology, which was that equated Stalin and his successors with Hitler as aiming at world conquest and trying to get the drop on us totally. In retrospect, that was not the case. They were certainly holding on to an empire in East Europe, in particular as a defense against Germany, and doing so in a totally authoritarian police state fashion. But they were not aiming at invasion of the West Europe, or of taking over the world, and they well understood that they were number two and always would be in terms of military power compared to the United States. But that was not perceived by anybody I knew, certainly in the late 50s. Now, what I was referring to was that by 1960, the Army and Navy intelligence had been saying for 2 years now that the Air Force and the CIA were wrong, that they had developed only a handful of missiles, which was right.
The way I learned this as a kid, Dan, was that John Kennedy accused Nixon and Eisenhower of being soft on this issue, and Nixon couldn't refute him because it was secret information, and so he had to just let the attack stand. I'm sorry, we have to go out to this break. We'll be right back with the heroic Daniel Ellsberg, liberator of the Pentagon Papers and author of this article, Hiroshima Day, at Ellsberg.net. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. The website is scotthorton.org. Find all my archives there. I'm talking with Daniel Ellsberg, heroic liberator of the Pentagon Papers, author of the books, well, the book, Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers, and the new one that he's working on, The American Doomsday Machine. His own website is Ellsberg.net, and if you look there or at truthdig.com, you can find this great article, Hiroshima Day. America has been asleep at the wheel for 64 years. So when we left off, Dan, we were talking about the missile gap, and the way I learned it as a kid was that Nixon, that Kennedy knew he was making it up when he said that Ike and Nixon had let the Soviets get way out ahead on nuclear missiles, but Nixon couldn't refute him without revealing what I am assuming is the Army report you're referring to about the state of Soviet missile technology at the time.
Eisenhower knew, the president at the time, knew that there was no missile gap, and he knew that because we were flying the U-2 over Russia, Soviet Union, and he didn't make that public because he felt that would lead the Soviets into more of a crash effort. I don't know, if it would have ruffled the Soviet-U.S. relations considerably, possibly pushed them into more of an arms race, if he'd revealed their humiliating situation that they couldn't then shoot down the U-2, which they did eventually in 1960 with a surface-to-air missile. But since he kept that secret very well from the American public, not from the Soviets, who knew that the U-2 was flying over, he couldn't use it in the campaign, or Nixon couldn't use it, knowing that we knew that they did not have, or we had adequate knowledge that they did not have it. The situation's a little more complicated than that, but that's basically the case. And certainly by early 61, especially later in 61, when we were flying reconnaissance satellites, it confirmed that the Soviets had only 4 ICBMs at a time when we had 40 plus thousands of bombers within range of Russia. What you've asked me, you know, how I got into this kind of planning, I think I've implied by saying that even today, with my total abhorrence of nuclear war, had the situation been what it was purported to be by the CIA and by the Air Force, and the RAND Corporation that I was working for at the time, worked for the Air Force and believed the Air Force estimates. Had that situation been true, I would have to say that it was not only reasonable, possibly even obligatory, to try to have a kind of retaliatory capability. That wasn't the real situation, so that wasn't the policy we should have been on. We were going in the wrong direction. But in early 1961, I became aware that the, as is in another piece on Ellsberg.net, which you can find along with that Hiroshima piece, I discovered that the force they had built in supposedly what I understood to be for retaliation or for deterrence actually proposed to kill 600 million people in the world, including 325 million in the Soviet Union and China alone, and the Chinese were to be killed in any conflict with the Soviet Union, just to take care of them at the same time, but also virtually 300 million people outside that, not only in East Europe, but in West Europe and in Afghanistan, in India and Japan and other countries that were in the neighborhood of the Soviet Union. So that went so incredibly far behind any reasonable requirement for deterrence, for deterring an attack, that it was a plan that, as some people in the administration called it, Eisenhower himself, overkill or redundant or wasteful, unnecessary, all of which it was. But better words would be immoral, insane, evil. And that has been the nature of our nuclear planning from that day to this. And that's 50 years ago.
All right, now, I want to talk about a lot of that because you have, at least two or three great pieces at TruthDig and at Ellsberg.net about the war planning in general and the planning for complete human extinction, basically. But still, I want to talk about Hiroshima, the inaugural event of our nuclear age, really. The attack, it's the anniversary, of course, today. You said earlier, and I think it was very important, you said that the reasons for the Hiroshima attack that were given to the American people were falsified. Could you please elaborate on that?
Well, this is one of the great hoaxes of human history, one could say. The justification that was given for the bomb, which everyone knows and nearly all Americans believe, is that the only alternative to satisfactory alternative for ending the war to using the bomb was an invasion later in the year in 1945 and in early 46, which was variously estimated by the Army at having 40,000 killed, the actual estimate that they made at the time, but described by Truman and others as 250,000, 500,000, sometimes as 1,000,000 U.S. dead and many Japanese dead, of course. So to avoid that, the only way of doing it was by dropping the bomb. Reality. Virtually almost none of Truman's advisors, civilian or military, believed by July 1945, when the final decisions were made to drop the bomb, believed that an invasion would be necessary by that time. The public didn't know that. The public had seen very fierce fighting in Okinawa up till that point, fighting to the death, even suicidally, by the Japanese, and they expected the same performance in Japan. The intelligence community and the commanders involved and the civilians knew that that was not the case, that contrary to the performance on Okinawa, the Japanese government was, and led by the emperor, was suing through the Russians for peace negotiations, and that the key element there was that they wanted was assurance that they could keep the emperor, which in fact we had decided we wanted them to keep order in Japan under MacArthur. And we wanted the emperor to be able to say surrender to his troops, get them down and to provide order. Whether or not that was a good decision, another matter, that was the decision. So the main thing they wanted, the Japanese wanted as assurance for surrender, was something that we were politically and in policy terms expecting to give them. But rather than announce that, which nearly all of Truman's advisors urged him to do, to propose that to the Japanese prior to the Potsdam meeting in July and prior, of course, to the bomb, rather than do that, Truman and Burns postponed any such offer deliberately until the bomb had been demonstrated, which had a number of benefits for them, justifying a $2 billion expense on the program, which otherwise they expected would be questioned and investigated, but in particular showing to the Russians that we were prepared to use that weapon against an adversary, even when the Russians knew and we knew it was not necessary to get surrender.
Dan,
that was a very powerful threat to the Russians, and Stalin did not fail to get that message.
Okay, now can I keep you one more segment here?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Everybody, it's Daniel Ellsberg, heroic liberator of the Pentagon Papers and keeper of the website Ellsberg.net. I highly urge you to read Chapter 1 of his book, Secrets, which you can find there and elsewhere on the net. We'll be right back after this. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. The website is scotthorton.org. 2,500 interviews there going back to 2003. ScottHorton.org. We're talking with Daniel Ellsberg, heroic liberator of the Pentagon Papers. His website is Ellsberg.net, and his book is Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers. I tried to cram it in there real quick before the end of the last segment, and it didn't quite work. Chapter 1 is available. You got to search around for it. I think it's at Ellsberg.net, but it's at other places online, too. Chapter 1 of Secrets is about, Dr. Ellsberg's first day on the job at the Pentagon as undersecretary of covering things up or whatever it was. And that was the day of the Gulf of Tonkin incident. You can get the full insider's view of that in Chapter 1 of Secrets. It's online. go and find it. And by the way, I did mention this. I mentioned it earlier in the show, but I forgot to mention it during this interview. There's an excellent documentary. I mean, it's really great. It's called The Most Dangerous Man in America, all about Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. You got to take a look at that. I'm really serious about it. But now we're talking about nuclear war. And, well, particularly the nuking of Hiroshima, because today's Hiroshima Day. And now, so you laid out really well the narrative about why it was necessary, Dan. And but the problem is, for me, is that even the narrative of why it's necessary, if you buy it at face value, that somehow it was just okay to insist on unconditional surrender, with or without the emperor or whatever, or to kill women and children, to nuke a city in the name of protecting the lives of American GIs who were going to have to invade the island. Now, again, taking at face value that that was even true, which I'm not saying we should necessarily, but for the sake of argument, would the Americans ever be justified in rounding up all of the women and children of Hiroshima, machine-gunning them to death? Like the Nazis would have done or something like that, if that is what it would have taken to make them surrender. For some reason, the instantaneous poof and they're all dead makes it more justifiable than if it was a machine gun massacre. You know what I mean? It seems like such a bogus argument, even on its face.
All right. Scott, you know, I congratulate you for raising that point because it's really rarely made, the argument you've just made, the questions you've just raised, are really very unusual in the half century and more of the discussion of this issue. The problem here is this. First of all, when I was 14, when the bomb was used, I already, you know, at that young age, was extremely uneasy about the implications of that having been done. The public was very applauding of it on the whole, with a number of other people also being very alarmed and uneasy about it at first. But that was so covered by the joy at the fact that the war was over and the misbelief that it would not have ended so quickly otherwise without the bomb. That was a fraudulent belief, but very plausible in terms of, you know, ad hoc poster hoc. The bomb was dropped. The war ended. Almost no Americans were aware that the Japanese had been suing for surrender secretly through the Russians, who were telling us, and we knew that through intercepting their intelligence and their communications and decoding them at that time. So the public didn't know that. The troops who thought they were on their way to Japan didn't know that. So they were very happy at this big surprise that the Japanese were willing to surrender. The leaders knew that. The Americans did not. They thought from Okinawa that they would not surrender under any conditions and that only the bomb, the amazing bomb, had brought this about. Now, coming though right to your point, there's more to say on that other point, but on your point, even given the rationale, you could say, were Americans justified in feeling happy that the war was over at the cost of killing these civilians, women, children, babies? Hardly any able-bodied men were in Hiroshima at that time. There were some troops there, as a matter of fact, home troops, but generally it was civilians who were killed. So the fact that I would put to you is that, unfortunately, the American people did accept the morality of that, which was virtually unprecedented in terms of public consciousness, because it meant accepting the morality of a terrorist act, of killing civilians, non-combatants, for a political purpose, ending the war. People would not threaten us individually or together. And wiping out, including infants. That was the largest, it was the second largest act of terrorism in history. The first having been also by the U.S. on March 9th and 10th, 1945, which was the firebombing of Tokyo, in which 80,000 to more than 100,000 people had been burned to death, as they were essentially in Hiroshima, burned and blasted to death there, and died of radioactivity. But dying, burning alive in the firestorm of Tokyo was no more humane than what the people of Hiroshima experienced. And we had been doing that deliberately to every major city in Japan from March 9th, 10th on. In other words, for 5 months, we'd been killing Japanese as fast and as many as we possibly could, and that was a lot. It added up to about 900,000 Japanese civilians before Hiroshima or Nagasaki. So put this in the moral context then in the following way. For Truman and his other leaders, the others around him, many of which were not eager to see the bomb used, unlike Truman and Burns and Groves and Oppenheimer and Bush and a few others, but many others unhappy to see it used, but nevertheless, it offered no new moral issue for them because it did exactly what we've been doing for the last 5 months. It did it a little more cheaply and efficiently with one bomber instead of 300. But we had 300. We had more than 300, and we're using them every day. So there was no new moral issue. Now, for the public, they hadn't had their noses rubbed in that exactly. It hadn't been a total secret what we were doing to Japan, but there wasn't a lot of publicity either. And, of course, nobody on the ground, no photographs or anything like that. So it wasn't too much in their consciousness. For the first time, they were really confronted with Hiroshima, that we had blotted out a city, not a military target, but civilians. And they had to consider whether that was justified. And they did. Given the explanation they were given, that this is the only way to avoid an invasion, no consideration given to having changed the surrender terms to terms we were willing to accept, actually, keeping the emperor. Not knowing that, I'm sorry to say the American people from that day to this accepted that that great act of terrorism was justified. And that is a terribly dangerous moral. You can call it immoral. But it's a form of morality which says that this is a lesser evil and that it's acceptable. And that's, of course, been the basis for our acceptance of our threats of nuclear weapons from that day to this. Mm. And we're threatening them right now against Iran when we say all options are on the table. No options are off the table. And that doesn't just mean military attack, which would be aggression, a crime against peace. If the Israel or the U.S. or both of them together attacked Iran now, it would be under the U.N. charter that we've ratified, clear-cut aggression, even without nuclear weapons. And they've added to that, that yes, we don't rule out the use of nuclear weapons against their underground sites. We're making threats, in other words, of another Hiroshima right now, which means that we're using the weapons because we're using them like a gun you point at somebody's head, whether you pull the trigger or not. We're using that weapon, and that's true of both major candidates right now, as it was 4 years ago.
All right. Now, we're almost out of time for this segment. Is there any chance I could keep you one more, or do you got to go?
Yeah, I'm okay.
Okay, great, because I want to ask you all about, you know, modern-day nuclear weapons and H-bombs and possible extinction of mankind. And again, Dan Ellsberg was a nuclear war planner, so he actually really knows something about this, not just from the Wikipedia entry or something, about how many humans could be expected to die in a week worth of nuclear war or something like that. Some of these kinds of questions that you've written about at truthdig.org I want to talk with you about. So hang tight, everybody. It's Dan Ellsberg. Ellsberg.net is his website. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. ScottHorton.org is the website. Keep all the archives there, including quite a few with Daniel Ellsberg on, of course, the Pentagon Papers, as well as Iraq War stuff and nuclear war stuff, which he's been writing about for the past, say, 3 years or so. Got a new book coming out, The American Doomsday Machine, I guess early next year, you said, right, Dan?
No, I'm finished early next year, I hope. No, it'll be a while. It'll be later in the year before it comes out. By the way, let me mention on my website, Ellsberg.net, the pieces we've been referring to find them, you go to Ellsberg.net and then look up archive. There's a button for archive. And then under archive, nuclear. And you'll see a bunch of nuclear articles, including the Hiroshima Day one 3 years ago that you referred to, and then another one you referred to, not by name, U.S. Nuclear War Planning for 100 Holocausts. That's what I was referring to moments ago when I said that I discovered that our planning in 1961 estimated that the effects of our using our first strike capability would be 600 million dead or 100 Holocausts.
Amazing. Now, at least in the truthdig.com version, I'm not sure if it's like this on your website, but you reprint this chart of how many fatalities are to be expected.
That's the one I'm referring to. It's the title under my archive and under nuclear is U.S. Nuclear War Planning for 100 Holocausts. But you know, something that wasn't known then in 61, which I... okay, two things that the planners themselves didn't know at that point, and certainly I didn't know. One, they were not accounting, of all things, for fire from the effects. They were looking at blast and immediate radiation as the cause of lethality. Fire is the main effect of these thermonuclear weapons, and yet they weren't calculating casualties based on that, on the grounds that it was too hard to estimate, too hard to predict. It depends on fuel and time of day, the weather, things like that. Actually, they could have estimated, but they chose not to. That would have doubled the casualties from 600 million to about at least over a billion, 1.2 billion or so. But even that was not really the measure of what we had prepared to do, because it took 20 more years from 61. It took till 1982 and 83 for Carl Sagan and Turco and a bunch of other scientists to reveal the probability of nuclear winter resulting from this, which was again an effect of the fire, namely the fire on cities, on combustible material and on forests, which would cause smoke. Something that no one had figured, but it would cause hundreds of thousands of tons of smoke to be lofted into the stratosphere by the effects of the weapons, where it would remain for what was in 1980s thought to be a year or two, what we now know from the latest calculations to be more like a decade. And that smoke would blot out the sunlight or reduce it to winter levels or fall levels in either case, destroying the crops, destroying the harvests, and leading the world to starvation of all humans, ourselves included, but all humans, and really all primates, all mammals, all animals dependent on vegetation and dependent on harvests and crops. A 10 years of twilight at best, which made growing impossible, which causes the extinction of our species and many, many other species, all so-called complex species. In other words, it was a true doomsday machine, a machine for extermination of life, on complex life on Earth. The bacteria would remain, the viruses would remain and take over, and perhaps some animals, a very low, what we regard as very simple animals, but otherwise, doomsday. And that could have happened in the Berlin crisis of 1961, in the Cuban Missile Crisis of 62, or any year thereafter, including this one. We are still poised with a doomsday machine, which the Russians, as I've said earlier, didn't have at that time. They hadn't built one. But getting rid of Khrushchev, in part because of our, quote, victory in the Cuban Missile Crisis, replacing him with Brezhnev, who gave the military what they wanted. What the military wanted was what the U.S. had, exactly what the U.S. had, which they achieved and in some respects surpassed for what that was worth, which was worth nothing. It bankrupted them. And the effect was then there has been two doomsday machines poised at each other, each prepared to go first in the event of a false alarm, of the kind of electronic false alarm that had actually happened a number of times. Even in as recently as 1993, a very serious false alarm, another one in 1983, still could happen today, could set off one or the other or both of these doomsday machines and end life on Earth.
Dan, let me ask you this real quick. I read this great article by a guy from the Los Alamos Study Group or something like that. It's an anti-nuclear activist group. I think I interviewed the guy, actually. And they made the case that there is this extremely powerful nuclear bomb manufacturer lobby in Washington, D.C. There's billions and billions, tens of billions of dollars at stake in the construction and the facilitation of this to continue on indefinitely, and there's virtually no one to oppose them. Do you have a take on that?
I wouldn't say no one, but no one in Congress speak of except Dennis Kucinich, whom we're losing, and some other members, no doubt, of the Progressive Caucus. Lynn Wilkie was good on this subject. She's leaving Congress at the end of this year. So there is, on the other hand, an ICBM caucus. That's a subset of what you were talking about in terms of a lobby. There's an actual caucus called the ICBM caucus from states where ICBMs are located, where
they're not even ashamed of it.
Local jobs are involved in maintaining the doomsday machine, in maintaining Minuteman missiles on alert, ready to go on a false alarm any moment. And to maintain the jobs, the restaurants, the barbershops, whatever, of the people in Idaho and Montana and North Dakota, where these things exist, and in Utah, where they're serviced, the missiles are serviced, those four states give us eight senators, three not from the most populous states in the country, you notice, eight senators who are for maintaining the doomsday machine, so for the purpose of these jobs and the votes that they involve, the ability with our Minuteman missiles to end life on Earth. Those missiles should not exist. They should not have existed as vulnerable land-based missiles subject to our own preemptive attack or to the Russians' preemptive attack. They shouldn't have existed for the last 40 years or so, even inside the Cold War ideology and the deterrence ideology of needing retaliatory strength. We have had Poseidon submarines, Polaris, Trident submarines now, at sea for all that time and more, totally invulnerable to Soviet attack. Not a temptation to the Soviets to attack, or even given a false alarm. Not under a temptation to launch quickly, like the Minutemen, lest they be destroyed in a false alarm. We've had those. The Minutemen have been totally, not only anachronistic and unneeded for the last 40 years and more, but 48 years, since about the mid-60s. Dangerous. Lightning rods for attack. Lightning rods for a doomsday machine on either side. It's inexcusable, intolerable, outrageous, evil that we have maintained those forces, and the Russians, too, have maintained comparable forces for the left. You could say for the entire period, but I'm emphasizing especially the last 50 years when there has been, even from the Pentagon's point of view, no real rationale for them at all. That's why a number of us got arrested at Vandenberg Air Force Base a couple of months ago, protesting a launch, a test launch of a Minuteman missile. In other words, a rehearsal for doomsday, a test of a doomsday machine, which should not exist. We're going on trial probably in October. I just got, and the others of us just got, a banning order from Vandenberg just the other day, actually, for the next 3 years. I'd get arrested if I set foot on Vandenberg outside the designated protest area outside the gates. Well, protest is needed. The fact is that, amazingly enough, a former head of Strategic Command general Cartwright has actually called for the abandonment of the Minuteman missile. He was in charge of them earlier, a few years ago. Now he says they should be given up. He's absolutely right. Will Congress do it in the face of this powerful lobby from North Dakota and Utah and Montana?
All right, I'm sorry. We have to leave it there, Dan. Thank you so much for staying, especially if you're staying this whole hour with us. I really appreciate it.
Okay, good to talk about this. The point you made earlier is very well taken. Congratulations.
Well, thank you. Well, good. Ellsberg.net, everybody. We'll be right back.
And that was a lengthy but still very instructive and still important discussion, a presentation about, it was about Hiroshima, and now, of course, we're at Nagasaki Day 3 days later, but about nuclear weapons that currently threaten extinction of all of us and that continue to be serviced and tested and funded. You're tuned to Free Radio 101.3 FM. Freak Radio is what we are. Stay tuned, and we'll return to some more local issues shortly. This is Robert Norse. Name of the show, Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, here in Santa Cruz.
Every Sunday, God wakes up to everybody's problems. All those voices asking for forgiveness. Half asleep, he waves his hand to quickly mass absolve them, wondering why he constantly relives this. I don't want to take that time away from someone who might really need a sign from God that day. Angel Michael on his knees, trying to find the time to help us. I don't need such expertise. I could never be that selfish. Isn't there a minor angel? Not an angel one might miss. I can talk to, I can turn to, there to handle this. Sunday mornings in the choir, I'm the one who's singing off key. By my bedside in the darkness, I will say my prayers so softly. Isn't there a lonely angel? Not an angel fully booked. I can call on, I can sing to someone overlooked. Just one angel, just one angel, angel only I can see. Just one angel, just one angel, watching over me. Sometimes when my heart is full, it makes me feel a bit frenetic. Fallen angel takes the bullet. Wouldn't that be so poetic? Isn't there a private angel, unremembered, underused? Second angel, no one's angel, someone God excused. Just one angel, just one angel, angel only I can see. Just one angel, just one angel, watching over me. All those days and nights God slaved to give us creature comforts. Why would we have free will if he thought we'd always call? Maybe it's a lack of sleep that keeps him feeling vengeful. Maybe he'd be sweet and soft if he could have his Sundays off. Just one angel, just one angel, angel only I can see. Just one angel, just one angel, watching over me. Just one angel, just one angel, watching over me.
And that was Just One Angel from Uncle Banzai's album, Apology. Well, we've heard Daniel Ellsberg on Scott Horton's daily interview. That's from the antiwar.org website. This is 101.3, in case you just tuned in. And the phone number here, in case you've got some thoughts or comments on Nagasaki Day, is 427-3772. And I'm going to take a very brief amount of time to mention the debate over the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I'm actually just kind of skimming the article on Wikipedia. And there, the pro and con, though it's kind of like reading, I don't know, arguments about the importance of the genocide of the Jews or something. You don't wonder about these pro arguments. There is the main argument, of course, is the one that was pointed out before by Ellsberg, that's preferable to invasion. That's the one I heard most frequently from people like my father, who served in the Army. And I tended to reject this argument early based upon the fact that it became clear to me, again, I was picking up revisionist historian texts of the 60s, which I read back then, that this was really done to impress the Soviet Union. How does one really resolve this issue, whether an invasion would have been necessary? Well, I guess deeper research, and again, on a longer show than I have. There's also the argument that a speedy end of the war saved other kinds of lives. So, for instance, here's a quote: for China alone, depending on what number one chooses for overall Chinese casualties, in each of the 97 months between July 1937 and August 1945, somewhere between 100,000 and 200,000 persons perished, the vast majority of them non-combatants. For the other Asian states alone, the average probably ranged in the tens of thousands per month. But the actual numbers are almost certainly greater in 1945, notably due to the mass death and a famine in Vietnam. Historian Robert P. Newman concludes that each month the war continued in 1945 would have produced the deaths of upwards of 250,000 people, mostly Asians, but some Westerners. End of the war liberated millions of laborers working in harsh conditions under a forced mobilization in the dusty Dutch East Indies. There was a forced mobilization of some 4 million, although some estimates are as high as 10 million. About 270 of these were sent to the outer islands and Japanese-held territories. The point, though, is would the war not have ended quickly given the intervention of the Soviet Union, which was just gearing up to start invading after it had ended its non-aggression pact with Japan? Another argument in favor of the bombing was this is part of total war because the Japanese government was waging total war, ordering civilians to work in factories to fight against any invading force. And that supposedly that Nagasaki was of strategic importance because it produced ordnance, ships, military equipment, and other war materials. You know, I pass on all these pro-bombing arguments not because I agree with them, but because I believe they have to be addressed, and they aren't mentioned in Daniel Ellsberg's discussion. And I don't usually mention them when I just briefly and passionately denounce this atomic bombing. Now, there's the claim the Japanese leaders refused to surrender and would not surrender. And there's a long discussion of this, and you can read more about this on, again, Wikipedia. The opposition, as you already heard from Ellsberg, was that the war is that the bombing, murdering civilians, men, women, and children who aren't military combatants is fundamentally immoral, to say the least. Although it was a continuation of the kind of firebombing that happened in Hamburg, Dresden, Tokyo, Nagoya, Osaka, and Kobe that they've been doing already, and that these were war crimes and form of crimes against humanity and state terrorism. Early critics of the bombings were Albert Einstein, Eugene Wigner, not sure who he was, and Leo Szilard, who had together spurred the first bomb research in 1939 with their letter to President Roosevelt. The main argument was that it was militarily unnecessary, and this is actually echoed by a lot of military people, including Dwight D. Eisenhower, who wrote in the White House years in 1945, Secretary of War Stimson visited my headquarters in Germany and informed me that our government was preparing to drop an atomic bomb on Japan. I was one of those who felt there were a number of cogent reasons to question the wisdom of such an act, and I voiced my grave misgivings on the basis that Japan was already defeated and dropping the bomb was completely unnecessary and our country should avoid shocking world opinion. The use of a weapon whose employment was no longer mandatory. Other U.S. military leaders who disagree with the necessity of bombing included the General of the Army, Douglas MacArthur, somebody you might not have expected would be anti-bombing, Fleet Admiral William Day Leahy, Brigadier General Carter Clark, military intelligence officer who prepared intercepted Japanese cables, and Fleet Admiral Chester W. Nimitz, Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet. State terrorism was another reason why this was considered to be, by those of us who oppose it, bad. Japanese nuclear weapons program was not developed, and it was the Nagasaki bombing was specifically unnecessary. There wasn't sufficient time between the bombings for the Japanese to understand the extensive damage done by the Hiroshima bombing. This was the specific about the Nagasaki bombing. Anyway, you can read more about it on Wikipedia if you'd like, and it's worth looking at these arguments and thinking about it more deeply insofar as it's really the first and only use of nuclear weapons, and of course it was the so-called democratically elected government of the United States that did so. And we're preparing for another one of these pseudo-democratic elections coming up between two proponents of nuclear weapons, Obama the bomber and Mitt Romney. I don't know what to call him. It's just they're both horrible. And the election is largely irrelevant in terms of this issue, which, of course, is probably one of the most important issues that we have to consider, even though we try to put it at the back of our minds because we feel utterly powerless about it. Online, a couple of new things. There was a there was a vigil for Ed Frey that I announced. He's the guy, the attorney who went to the mattress, actually, in 2010 with Peace Camp 2010, set up a safe zone for homeless people in front of the courthouse, along with other Huff members and homeless people and activists who jumped on board and took leadership roles, like Kerbugger Chris Doyen, more recently known as Commander X, now in flight from prosecution for federal, in short-term hacking charges. Ed Frey was sentenced to 6 months in jail, appealed the sentence. The appeal was denied. His crime was this peaceful protest that he did for 3 months in front of the courthouse. You would think that such a protest would not be illegal. He wasn't accused of damaging any property, injuring any people, but he was accused of essentially not obeying authorities when they told him to leave. So I guess the lesson is you have a democracy until such time as authorities decide they tell you to leave. If that's the lesson they wanted us to learn, perhaps we've learned it too well. I know that at the protest on Tuesday night and Wednesday morning, when Ed was reporting to jail, not to actually go to jail, but to get an ankle bracelet for which you have to pay $18 a day, as I understand it. So homeless and poor people have no option to do that, even if they would be allowed to do it. And Ed's an attorney, so he has sort of special privileges, unlike, I think, most ordinary citizens faced with this situation, though I guess some number of non-attorneys can get ankle bracelets if they can pay for them. The night before, people did a protest in front of the courthouse. That was on Tuesday night. I was there. I snoozed in my car for a while, apparently in violation of the downtown ordinances. Come and get me, police officers. I'm confessing on the air. It's a crime for homeless people to go to sleep after 11 o'clock, either in a vehicle, even if it's properly and legally parked, even if the car is registered, licensed, and insured, even if nobody's complaining and no one's injured, even if it's done for a First Amendment purpose. It's a crime in Santa Cruz, and this gives the police a powerful option to suppress protest and to drive people away from any area they choose to drive them away from, which I guess some find a virtue, so that means your guardians of the law, if they find some kind of disorder, can deal with it. Others think that is a license for abuse by authority and police officers and those in power, and also an immiseration of those who have no choice but to sleep outside, which is something, of course, I constantly talk about on this show. What I noticed, and what this is leading to, this discussion right now, is that at this protest, there's also not just a law against sleeping at 11. There's also a second ordinance. It wasn't voted on by the Board of Supervisors, but it was simply asserted by the CAO, the Chief Administrative Officer of the county, Susan Mariello, when she decided to end the protests around the county building last winter by posting no trespassing signs. The notion being that the authorities can trespass on the Constitution all they want, but protesters better not sit outside public buildings with signs after 7 o'clock, at least not the Santa Cruz County building or the Santa Cruz courts, because that would be illegal. It's even illegal earlier to be there than it would be to be in the nearby parks, which are open until dusk or until sunset. Although that, again, is a direct attack on homeless people who often have no other place to go than to sleep in parks. Or that seems to be a safer place than more distant and more dangerous areas, and also environmentally better because they're near bathrooms that open in the morning, at least. They do their best to keep them shut at night, the authorities do, as part of their wise let them crap in the bushes so we can later complain about it and use it as an excuse to drive away homeless people and increase police and parks and ranger appropriations and rant and rave about the crime situation. Anyway, the establishment of this curfew, the 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. curfew, was, to their credit, ignored by people in front of the county building. And they were there to protest and stay there vigiling all night for Ed Fry in honor of his own three-month vigil 2 years before, where he actually provided space for 50 to 60 homeless people for the first month and a smaller number thereafter as if when he was driven away from the county building and kind of then continued the protest in front of the city hall, where the actual city authorities continued to maintain this vicious anti-homeless ordinance, the camping law, the sleeping ban sections of the camping ordinance, which make it illegal to sleep or cover up with blankets after 11 o'clock at night. The thing I noticed was, and it may just be difference of tactics, was that on Tuesday night when the deputies came, and you're going to hear some of this in some of the material I'll either be playing today or on Sunday when I have a longer show in the morning, the protesters were told by the sheriffs that they had to leave by 9:30, I believe it was, even though the sign said 7 o'clock. And some people might say, well, you know, look at that, how nice those sheriffs are to allow the Constitution to continue for another 2.5 hours. But, of course, what it really says is that the sheriffs will do whatever they want, regardless of what the law says. They can say, you can go violate the law if you want, if we say so, or even if there's no law, we'll arrest you for an alleged violation if we say so. Though the idea that people should sort of slavishly or slavishly follow this kind of dictate, to me, is outrageous and depressing. But, of course, realistically speaking, given the kind of heavy attack on activists who actually did nothing more than walk into a vacant bank building with no police objecting back in late November and early December, of which I was one, are now charged with 2 felonies and 2 misdemeanors each. We go to court in about a week and a half. It's understandable how people may be a little bit nervous that they don't know what they can do, because who knows what the authorities can charge them with. There seems to be no way of holding in bounds deputies, police, rangers, and district attorneys who decide the First Amendment means what they say it means. Maybe somewhere down the road, some legal cases might help out, although the Supreme Court is not the most hopeful place to go. And the real hope, to me, for the last year, has lain in the movement of people, large numbers of people standing up and asserting their rights. Well, what happened at Occupy was that and this really was sort of a kind of a combined Occupy, Peace Camp 2010, Huff, a bunch of other groups got together and were supportive of Ed Fry. And it's not just Ed Fry, the right of the citizenry to peacefully protest and also outrage at a sentence, an outrageously, abusively long sentence for an individual whose only service was a public service to the community, Ed Frye. And that same situation is coming up for Gary Johnson on August 24th when he will be, or he has been ordered to, well, he goes back to court and he will then be ordered to go to jail. He will not have the option, probably, for an ankle bracelet first because he doesn't have the professional privilege that an attorney has. And he also has spent, he decided last winter that this was still outrageous. He was not going to surrender his constitutional rights under this blackmail threat of jail. And he's continued to sleep in front of the county building with a sign that said sleep is not a crime. And he was arrested repeatedly and then tried and sentenced to 2 months in jail to the shame of the jury that convicted him under the 647E law. All of which I've talked about many times before, but the new information is a great story by Alex DeRosi. On August 8th, several community members involved with Occupy Santa Cruz wrote messages in lightly, brightly colored chalk on the sidewalk in front of the Santa Cruz courthouse. You can go and actually see this great photographic coverage that Alex does of the chalking that happened. This was actually a day later after the vigil. And I guess the one point I was trying to make, and I had a hard time getting to it because I'm so much into the background, is that when the deputies came at, they didn't come at 9:30, they came actually about 10:15 or 10:30 on Tuesday night and told people to leave, everybody, without exception, crowded like frightened mice, myself included, onto the sidewalk. You know, they yowled at the deputies, they denounced them. But not one of them just simply sat quietly with a sign and said, no, I'm not going anywhere. I have a right to be here. Do what you need to do. And that would have been a more powerful statement than any ranting and raving and shouting and waving of signs and leaving the area. And there was one person who was willing to do it. She said she was, and I believe she was, because 9 months before she had done exactly the same thing when this no trespassing law was suddenly announced by the county. She got arrested and taken to jail, and she was held there, and the DA said they were going to postpone the trial for a year and hang it over her head and actually interview her, and you'll be able to hear her talking about it. But she said she was getting tired of waiting around for the police to show up. She was ready to be there at 9:30. She was there at 9:30. She left about 10 or 15 minutes before the deputies arrived because she said she had work to do the next morning and she was going to leave. She wanted to assert her right to be there. She had, and she left on her own schedule. The trouble is the rest of us left when directed to do so by the deputies, and that's the sad thing. Now, it will be said, however, is my observation, that many people came back after the deputies left, and the deputies, who could see this quite clearly because it was quite visible, nobody was being surreptitious or sneaky about it, did nothing for the rest of the night. So it was just a threat. But like this threat of a nuclear weapon, you know, that they use against each other in this doomsday machine, threatening to use a court process that can impoverish people, they can jail them, take away their liberties, make them lose their job, their health, their reputation in the community, it is something very, very real and dangerous in the hands of authorities. It's nothing to sneeze at. It's nothing to, it's not necessarily easy to stand up to. So, check it out on Indy Bay, Occupy Santa Cruz Chalks in solidarity with Occupy LA. And I've actually posted a few of my own comments there, and other people have as well. And again, as I understand it, the chalking that happened the next night, there was a sort of a chalk-in in solidarity with a chalking that happened today throughout LA, for which some people were arrested, and I'll read a little bit about that in a moment. People didn't chalk anywhere but in this one little space. I wasn't there, but this is the second-hand report I've gotten, at the so-called Occupy Plaza, the area that Occupy Santa Cruz had its general assemblies at and still has its general assemblies at every Wednesday at 6 o'clock. Next general assembly is Sunday. I think they're having a special 2 o'clock general assembly on the steps of the county building right around the corner because there's a mime troupe production that is coming up, and the Occupy Santa Cruz supporters, the supporters of the Santa Cruz 11, 11 people charged with reporting on or supporting a protest inside a vacant bank building that was peaceful, lasted 3 days, ended peacefully. And 2 months later, people are now faced 7 years in jail for being a supporter of, a reporter on, or a whistleblower against Wells Fargo Bank, the owner of that property. There's going to be this sort of a series of protests at the Mime Troop events, which happen on Saturday and Sunday this weekend in San Lorenzo Park. So the Occupy Santa Cruz chalking protest that happened yesterday was kind of a direct action. It was originally intended to be against the banks, to let the citizenry join in, again, exposing the fraud closures, some call them, of the large banks, where people are continuing to lose their homes. Businesses are getting closed down as well, I imagine. The banks are continuing to be bailed out by the government. And there's no end to this ongoing scam. The movement that opposed it has been largely reduced to debating societies inside quieter venues, not entirely, but somewhat. And so there was going to be this chalking event, sort of in solidarity with an event that was happening in Los Angeles that also had to do with the police abuse against people in Anaheim, where two people were shot dead by a police department down there. Instead, as I said, they chalked the area right in front of the courthouse. And at least they chalked it. I wasn't there chalking it, so, you know, I want to say that. Chalking the sidewalk with erasable chalk and political messages is a traditional First Amendment activity. It doesn't involve any destruction of property. It can be easily washed away. Yet Santa Cruz authorities in the last decade have chosen to start prosecuting activists for doing this. And the prospect of that prosecution frightened Occupy Santa Cruz folks and made them, I think, far more cautious about what they were doing. Although, ironically, it's, you know, it was... I don't really know why, and perhaps people who are listening might want to call in who are participants and comment on this. I'm just, it's an open question in my mind. But the idea that people's political protest options are being frozen and reduced by police pressure seems to be something definitely very real and very chilling. So, the situation, however, with chalkers in Los Angeles is another issue, which I'm going to try to see if I can get some information on here online. Let's see. The Huffington Post has an article on it. Occupy LA chalk protest coming back to downtown LA. One arrest already. It's been updated. Members of the Occupy LA movement have made plans to chalk up downtown LA Thursday evening. That's tonight. But event organizers promised the Chalkopee, as they call it, won't interfere with the downtown LA art walk. Event organizers for Occupy LA are planning a peaceful art and music festival of their own, gathering at Pershing Park to get the word out about whom they say are victims of last month's police brutality. Occupy LA writes, the festival will include food to share, a market of free stuff, plans on being confined to Pershing Square until the park closes at 10:30, a nonviolent, peaceful family event. And one person is even pleading, well, Joe Moeller, executive director of Downtown LA Art Walk, pleads, don't chalk the walk. Don't chalk the walk. Small businesses, artists, and gallery owners depend on the success of every month's art walk to continue their businesses. And we humbly ask the protesters not to disrupt events. I don't see how chalking the walk is going to disrupt anything, although the idea of spreading the message of disrupting criminal behavior by large banks and the military-industrial complex seems to me to be a very good idea, and that kind of disruption is actually going to improve the business climate at some point, unless the business climate is in the business of fronting for these criminal groups. The city of L.A. denied the group a permit for their gathering, and they said a permit for the purposes of chalking does not fit within the parameters of our permitting structure because the use of chalk to deface public or private property is not lawful. One person has already been arrested in advance of the evening's events, reports the LA Times, and the story is developing. And there is a series of photos online here, and I think there's also some more stuff about this, which I will try to bring up, some more recent commentary, or actually news reports. Let's see if there's anything. Two Occupy protesters fight over chalking. One man arrested, LAPD says. Of course, they want to emphasize that this is a lot of violence and has nothing to do with the First Amendment and so forth. This seems to be the kind of spin that establishment media likes to put on this kind of stuff. But let's see what they say, if we can actually get this very pokey computer to get it together. Here we go. There's not much of a story. Argument at downtown L.A. Pershing Square broke out between a protester from L.A. and one from Oakland. According to the LAPD, the Oakland member criticized the man from L.A. about the quality of his chalking. That prompted the chalker to assault the person. Oakland man made a citizen's arrest. This really isn't about the chalking at all, of course. And so if they aren't arresting people for chalking after having again tried to intimidate them away from this by threatening them with arrest, this is good. I'm glad that people in L.A., and of course there are more people down there, and in strength there is numbers, and in strength there's also courage. We have a caller. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert.
Robert, this Hello? Isn't about chalking either.
Hi.
This is to let you and Free Radio listeners know that Free Radio is back to full power.
Yeah, I heard something about
that.
The
watts.
And you're going to be coming in, and no doubt, and blasting your music out at 8 o'clock, eh, Uncle Dennis?
That's true, Uncle Robert.
Well, that's good. Anything coming up on the show tonight?
The new transmitter went on the air last night and seems to be working fine. So listeners can pick us up all over Santa Cruz and out into SoCal, Capitola, Aptos, most of the way to Scotts Valley, all over the west side. We are back to full power.
Well, that sounds good. That sounds good. Are you anything coming up that we should know about on your show that's happening?
Music and beer. That's what it's all about.
Music and beer. Well,
and then, of course, at 9 o'clock, we have the Earth First Update, which I'm working on here diligently, getting the show ready.
You don't get to sip it, but you get to hear you talk about it, the beer, that is.
Yes.
Indeed.
That's correct.
Well, good. Update you. We can all get updated at 9 o'clock, those of us who listen in, and the rest of us can say, go, Dennis, go.
All right. Do want to thank the Free Radio listeners who made the new transmitter possible. And encourage all Free Radio listeners to make a donation to keep independent pirate radio on the air. Go to our website, www.freakradio.org, and participate with your dollars.
And I'd like to thank Free Radio for standing behind me in my own attempt to continue reports coming out in spite of the threat of prosecution that's coming up in a week and a half for me, and for your own personal support. Thank you, Dennis.
No problem, Robert. See you in a while.
All right, man. Bye-bye. Dennis and Free Radio did vote to support the Santa Cruz 11 and specifically to support me as a person charged with criminal reporting of a protest event. Actually, that's the charges are vandalism and conspiracy to commit vandalism. And I guess, I don't know, my voice apparently causes great consternation in some quarters, or mine is the only face they recognize, or one of the few. There's a previous article about police chalking in L.A. that sparked an uprising, and this might be one of the concerns. This was back in July. A protest over activists being arrested for chalking messages on sidewalks erupted into a near riot on Thursday, July 12th. in downtown L.A. Members of Occupy L.A. held a planned act of civil disobedience over what they argue is their constitutionally protected right to chalk politically sensitive messages on the sidewalk. The event was staged during the monthly L.A. Art Walk, apparently the previous month's Art Walk, where L.A.'s art galleries and artists can showcase their wares. Occupiers wrote messages on sidewalks using the non-toxic, water-soluble chalk that is marketed to children, sold in Palace Art Stationery downtown. Protesters sang free chalk for free speech, handed out chalk to passersby, many of whom participated in the civil disobedience. See, this is what I think we need to do here in Santa Cruz. I guess I should whip out the chalk. I'm a little wary because my concern is if I get the police decide they want to arrest me for anything under the sun, the judge may decide that I am not obeying all laws, even though some of these laws may be unconstitutional or they're not actually being violated, but the police have decided that it's time to take things in hand or in truncheon, as the case may be. Continuing with this story from a month ago, but which I think is probably still pertinent to what's happening tonight in L.A., although it looks like they're not, I haven't heard any reports of riots down there or attempts to arrest people chalking, nor do I know for that matter whether people are out there giving out chalk and having passers-by join them, which really is the way to go. Although tense with emotion after eight occupiers and non-occupiers were arrested for chalking, occupiers were on the verge of leaving by 9 p.m. However, a large crowd began to amass at the intersection of 5th and Spring Streets, where a sizable contingent of riot-clad LAPD officers stood on standby. The crowd seemed seemingly incensed by the police presence. Oh, gee, why would that be? Demanded that they leave and taunted them with gestures. Occasionally, plastic and glass bottles were thrown at cops. According to LA Times, four officers were injured, one suffering a minor concussion. And there's a photo of a guy bearing the side of his rib cage. Charles Shepard, an Art Walk attendee, shows photographers his wound after being shot by police with a beanbag projectile. The LAPD arrested 17 people related to the civil disobedience and uprising. It is certain that at least eight were for chalking, the first arrest occurring within 15 minutes of leaving Pershing Square, the protesters' starting point. I'm surprised I didn't hear about this last month. I guess, again, when you get obsessed with other things, like defending yourself in court or the local issues, you don't necessarily hear about this stuff. The arrests we witnessed were for chalking sidewalks. However, private property had also been marked with chalk during the uprising. It is not discernible if occupiers engaged in the vandalism, and again, to call it vandalism with erasable chalk is a stretch. For sure. I don't think it's inaccurate. Or if it were done by numerous people who were given chalk by occupiers. Although they participated in the uprising, occupiers made up only a fraction of the hundreds of people who joined the protest. And that, therein lies the hope. Occupier Caro Zimananska spent part of the protest playing hopscotch with children. Sounds like activist Becky Johnson, who was arrested after she put down chalked some slogans on the sidewalk and also a hopscotch matrix. Wrote a story about it, which you can read on the Santa Cruz Indie Media under the chalking story I mentioned earlier. There was one woman who was chalking, and she got grabbed and slammed onto the sidewalk face first by police. Police shot at least two people with beanbag rounds fired from shotguns, although it is not clear why, as these moments were not marked by any violence on the part of the demonstrators. Zimananska said police tried to grab her while she was attempting to assist one of the protesters wounded by the less lethal rounds. It is really shocking the amount of escalation they had over chalking, which really makes me think what we are doing has hit a nerve with them, she said. I mean, had any other group decided to be like, hey, let's chalk at Art Walk, this wouldn't have happened. So it's interesting, not only were they was chalking per se a protected activity as far as I'm concerned by the First Amendment, but they were chalking along with the kind of things that on a day when others would normally be chalking, which really dramatically shows how selective the police are in going after people who chalk political messages. It's not that they're chalking at all, it's that they're chalking political messages. Direct attack on people's constitutional rights. Zimananska's opinion is shared by the many occupiers who are accusing the LAPD of attempting to silence their dissent. In their argument, they are citing a 1995 court case, McKinney versus Nielsen, where the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the police lacked the justification to arrest a protester who was marking the sidewalk with chalk. No reasonable person would believe that writing with chalk would damage a sidewalk, stated the court. Ironically, the protester, Christopher McKinney, was chalking, "A police state is more expensive than a welfare state. We guarantee it," at the time of his arrest. More recently, it was ruled by a federal judge in Florida that Orlando police violated the First Amendment rights of Timothy Osmar, an Occupy protester who was arrested twice for chalking political messages. "It is definitely unconstitutional to arrest somebody for chalking on a public sidewalk," said L.A. Occupier Cheryl Etchley, who recently wrote an article on the arrest for the L.A. Progressive. According to LAPD Lieutenant Peter Cassie, who was present at Thursday's demonstrations, police are applying Penal Code 594, an anti-vandalism law. If found in violation, a vandal could face up to a year in jail and $1,000 in fines. During OLA's, Occupy LA's, occupation at City Hall, the LAPD gave occupiers a wide berth from their zest for law enforcement, but according to occupiers, all that changed significantly on May 29th when the Occupy LA began protesting the Central City Association, a powerful downtown business lobby. "This is about the time when the chalking arrests really ramped up," said Aishelli. "In the interest of local business and multinational corporations, the CCA, Central City Association, lobbies city and state governments. The group has also lobbied the city attorney and the LAPD for tougher policing on Skid Row. Recently, their efforts got them 40 additional police officers to target the homeless or what is commonly termed quality of life issues, such as aggressive panhandling and people sleeping on sidewalks in the Skid Row area. Occupiers have been camping out nearly every night to protest CCA's efforts to, according to activists, push the poor and homeless out of the downtown so as to attract more investors." Again, this is a story dated July 12th in downtown LA of this year, which tends to show that there is life in Occupy LA and perhaps in other Occupies, as activist Keith McHenry has repeatedly stated in interviews and giving the, giving the lie, giving the, making me have to reassess my position, my gloomy thoughts that the Occupy movement is dead. It is not dead. It's still going on, and I want to commend those people who are standing up for the poor people down there and the people up here. Occupy LA has enlisted the help of Carol Sobel, an attorney with the National Lawyers Guild. She submitted a letter dated June 5th to Gerald Chalif, LAPD's Special Assistant for Constitutional Policing, informing him of the McKinney court ruling. However, despite the notification, the chalking arrests continued. Until yesterday, there had been 12 arrests for chalking, which occurred since the beginning of the CCA demonstrations. Through the help of Sobel, occupiers hope to get a court injunction that will stop the arrests. Ryan Rice, an occupier who has been present for many of the CCA demonstrations, figures the total of arrests for all infractions which are designed to target the homeless, such as no sitting or lying down on the sidewalk after 6 a.m., to be upwards of 20 or more. "The significance of that number is that these were not planned arrests," he said about the chalking incidents. "We didn't sit in the street and plan for them to take us one by one. These have been in the dead of night. They've been totally unexpected." Rice feels that police are being pressured by this community business association to end the demonstrations. He said one officer admitted to an occupier that the arrests were unnecessary. "It's a situation where they are clearly being ordered to do this, and they know they could be doing something more productive," he said. "All signs point to following the money. I assume the LAPD doesn't give a shit about chalking, but it's happening right in front of a building that controls the town. Police activity since the CCA protests have taken on a more heavy-handed tone. In June, we reported that 20 to 30 cops were sent in to arrest two occupiers and a non-occupier for sitting on the steps of a downtown office building near the CCA. Police never provided the arrestees with a warning or an opportunity to leave. According to occupiers, none of the arrests held up in court." Arrests for chalking have been similar, sometimes with the aid of the Downtown Center Business Improvement District's private security force. Here we call them the First Alarm Security. Those are the guards that originally came on Tuesday night to warn people that they had to leave at 7 o'clock, and then the deputies came later and said, "Oh, you can stay till 9:30. And occupiers went and told the First Alarm CC. They said we could stay until 9:30. So None of the nightly demonstrators at the CCA have been violent or resulted in vandalism, said Rice. He assumes organizers are being targeted because of their outreach, such as with Skid Row's homeless development. He said that may leave the city's power structure more than a little nervous. If we can get a true network of solidarity between Skid Row homeless people and lower middle class people, then it's a whole new ballgame, and I think the state knows that. Art Walk attendees mostly expressed bewilderment over the fact that chalking a sidewalk was illegal. Possibly none could have been more puzzled and outspoken than 12-year-old Carmelo Rodriguez, who joined the occupiers' protest while walking through downtown. When he was told people were getting arrested for chalking, he said it was the most ridiculous thing he ever heard of in his life. Let me put it this way. They used to chalk when they were kids, too, and people loved chalk, he said. So what are they going to tell Crayola? You're not allowed to sell any chalk products? Rodriguez said he would like to be Martin Luther King Jr. when he grows up, minus getting murdered, of course. He expresses sympathy for police who have to make the chalking arrests. The cops have better things to do than arrest a whole bunch of kids, he said. I think what the cops sign up for is not what they think they're going to sign up for. I can't even feel the cops on this one, because they are probably regretting it too, but they have orders. However, when it comes to chalking in the law, Rodriguez is pretty clear on the issue. It's not vandalizing. It washes away. It doesn't leave a scar or a mark. I think it's a whole bunch of hogwash. And that's written by Dan Blumel, editor of the LA Activist. This is on Dick and Sharon's LAProgressive.com website, which people can check out, and I'm going to add it as a something people can read if they go to the Santa Cruz Indie Media chalking article. Enough of me. Let's hear a little bit. Well, you can hear more of me anyway, but you'll hear me interviewing people in a moment. You can also hear you if you call in on free radio. And you can do that at 427-3772, 427-3772. Got about a half an hour left in the show, so call in if you'd like. Let's hear some street interviews. I'm going to begin with a street interview that I began to play back on Sunday. Again, this is one of these interviews I guess we're talking about last Monday, a week ago Monday, at the Red Church, which is the Calvary Episcopal Church, where there's free food and a new program, the ISSB, Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program, sort of a very small shelter program for vulnerable people, which has been begun at the behest of some of the church leaders, Joel Miller and others. But here is some of the interviews there.
A non-good thing. We were harassed last night. Everybody was harassed last night by Officer Coffey on the levee after he reported, allegedly, that he got a report that there was something going on at 2:30 in the morning and everybody out there was asleep.
And how many people were involved in this? How many people got contacted?
What would you say?
We were all for displaced last night and threatened with jail.
I have to open. And where did he what did he say to you exactly?
We were told at 2:45 in the morning that we had 5 minutes to grab our belongings, otherwise we were going to jail.
And this, where did everybody go? Did they just...
Well, just bolted, left. Just grabbed, you know, what meant something to them, what meant most to them, and ran.
How many police officers were involved?
One, Officer Coffey, and that was the only officer.
What was the incident he was concerned about?
We were never told of any incident. He said one time that he had reserved a complaint, and that's why he was out there. And there was no complaint that we ever knew of.
It was one of the quietest nights on the levee I've been out there since. And
this was last night?
Yeah. It was quiet. Everybody was sleeping. Everybody was quiet. There was no arguing. There was no fighting. And I think it was pretty unwarranted, to be honest.
This was all in one particular plate on a levee, like under the Soquel Bridge, or where was this?
In between where CBS is.
The Walk Bridge and Soquel Bridge.
And how many people would you estimate sleep on a levee every night?
Up to 50?
Yeah, I would say at least.
Up to 50?
If not more.
And has the crackdown by police lessened that number?
I don't think so.
I think that it just makes people more likely to go to jail for no good reason, basically.
And has anyone you know been taken to jail for sleeping on a levee?
Not so far. I've only been back in town a week. I was born and raised here. I've been here 29 years, but I've only been back in town 5 days. So far I haven't seen anybody get arrested, but there's been very stern threats. There's been a constant police presence in the park.
Well, you feel safer now that they have any police around.
Oh, hell no. Of course, I feel less safe with them around.
And we've also been talking with
Blaze.
As well as
Crystal.
Thank you both. So again, we're talking with
Blaze.
Go ahead, Blaze.
I myself have been threatened repeated times with tickets for littering, even though the officer didn't see me throw anything down.
And this is what, you're sleeping in an area that has some litter?
Yes.
So I've suggested, and actually it's been suggested to me, that instead of people getting sleeping tickets, they should get only littering tickets and only if they don't clean up the area when they leave.
Correct.
So that's my suggestion there. You've been threatened with such tickets but not been given them.
No, we've not been given them. We've just been threatened with them. I mean, I myself believe if the homeless were left alone to sleep in that area, and with the understanding that the area would be cleaned up in the morning and everything would be out at a certain time, that it wouldn't be such a big problem. And the officers, they're spending their time on nothing, could be spending their time on something better.
Waking up pregnant people.
Yes.
Say that again, but
waking up pregnant people and displacing them in the middle of the night when they're trying to sleep.
Are you yourself in that condition?
Yes, I am.
How's the baby coming?
The baby is great. I am 5 months pregnant right now and waiting for the shelter to let me in.
How long have you been on the waiting list?
Just this week. Yeah, just 4 or 5 years. My entire life.
No, pregnant that long? No.
A little under a week.
Thank you. So we're talking with
Tyler. I was wondering.
Go ahead, Tyler.
Back out in San Lorenzo a couple months ago. I got a question that, see if anybody can answer. When are the cops going to let us have a place to sleep without harassing us? Where are we supposed to go when they come up and tell us we can't sleep in the woods? Even the ones that, like me, I keep my area cleaned up. I help keep the peace and stuff. It takes one person to come down to anywhere, scream and holler one time, and then everybody's judged. When are we going to be able to have that? When are we going to have peace again out here? That's what I want to know.
Thank you, Taylor. How long have you been in town?
I've been here for almost 3 years.
And
I've been getting harassed by the cops the whole time.
Has it changed in the last few months or not?
It's changed a lot.
How so?
Cops are busting down on people that are not doing nothing wrong. I mean, we can be standing, smoking a cigarette, and be a foot on the wrong side of the line that we're supposed to be, and they'll harass us about it.
And what do you think accounts for this?
People being stupid and not listening to the law, even though someone says, hey, look, you're not supposed to do that. They'll say, oh, fuck it. They don't care because...
So you don't blame the police, you blame...
I blame the police, I blame them all.
Okay.
You know, I've done my share of stupid shit, but I ain't going to sit there and... If a cop says, hey, you can't be smoking right there, you got to go over here. Well, what's the difference? No. They say that right there, you got to abide by the law. You know, you ain't got to be a friend to the cops, but you got to listen to the law because the government's the one that makes the laws.
You got the big guns, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. And it's stupid the way they treat us, though.
And what do you do if the law, though, is wrong and illegal or unconstitutional or a violation of human rights?
I do what my probation officer says. I'll file a report. And then that cop will not be able to mess with me anymore.
And has that worked in the past?
I haven't done it yet, but I'm fixing to try it. Because there's a couple of cops out here that I'm going to have put reports on, so they'll leave me alone. It's because that I'm a junkie, so what?
Which officers are you thinking of?
One of them is one that arrested, that was part of the group that arrested me last year on the shelter property. And while I was in the hospital where they broke my ribs, they told one of the officers that hit me told the judge that he hit me four times. Yeah. Four times in seven different places. And when I was in the hospital, I didn't have to go to the bathroom, so I couldn't give them a urine sample, and they asked for blood, and I said no, and one of the officers let his deputy sit there and say either, I gave my blood freely, or they're going to tie me down and take it, which is illegal. And I'm filing a report on that.
Name of the officer?
I can't remember the name of him, but when I see his picture, I will be able to get his name then. And when I get his name, I'll bring it to you.
Thank you, man. And we've been talking with?
Tyler, right.
Thanks, Tyler.
You're welcome. Yeah.
So, Dreamcatcher, you two were on part of this levee clearing at 245. What was that about?
Well, we had some suspects running in front of the searchlight, and that's what gave me a clue. And then loudspeaker says, all right, everybody's got 2 minutes to pick up everything and leave. If not, you're going to jail. So I was out of there within a minute and a half. And
it's kind of a time speedy thing. You know? Well, sort of a train you to zip around.
Well, you got to be prepared for that call. And like my trailer and my bike, I only unload my bedding. So I scoop all my bedding up in my big old bag, and I throw it on top of my trailer, strap it down, and I'm out of there. And I found an alternative place to sleep, and I didn't have anybody follow me, and I slept the rest of the night, and then went back over to the park when it opened at sunrise, and went back to sleep. That was okay.
Now, in the last week, how many times have you been hassled in your sleep? Is that only that one night? Or?
That was just last night, yeah. They've been pretty lenient until we started leaving too much trash, and it's starting to look like another Occupy. I can understand their feelings because I understand. I'm Dreamcatcher, and thank you.
And thank you, Dreamcatcher.
You're welcome, sir.
So we're talking with...
Santa Cruz is very generous. We've, for the most part, had a very good impression. The only bad impressions I got were some people are a little wild and not very friendly, and then there's... You got your law enforcement. They push a lot of people around, but I don't stick around to be pushed around by anybody, so I just observe from a distance, and I stay far away.
What's your name?
Peanut.
And how long you been in town?
For 7 or 8 days.
Where are you coming from?
Santa Barbara. I'm on my way to Garberville.
And is that, you got a home there, or why Garberville?
Well, because we'll be moving up there and be making a home up there, and we'll be going to the Cannabis College.
Oh, and what is the Cannabis College?
It's all about growing marijuana for medicinal purposes, and also, I advocate, well, not really advocate, but I'm all for the legalization of marijuana, so it won't be, law enforcement and the government don't have to hassle with it. You know, they have a war on everything from pot to heroin, and not that I really care. I don't want anything to do with hard drugs. I don't like that. I don't want anything. I once had someone offer me meth in Santa Barbara years and years ago, and I said, no thanks.
Are you a Santa Barbaran, pretty much? Or?
Well, I was a resident of Santa Barbara on and off for 22 years, and but I moved away from there.
Were you houseless down there?
Yeah, I was for 15 years.
And were you part of the Homeless People's Association or the Homeless Coalition or any of that stuff?
Not really. I was kind of on the outside of that because I rode a bicycle as opposed to driving a car.
Where did you sleep at night?
And anywhere where I could lay my head, just in and out areas, areas where I could just, I didn't repeat use too much. I just use every once in a while just different parts of Santa Barbara and Goleta and Isla Vista.
Now, as an attractive, somewhat petite woman, have you had any problems defending yourself, or has that been an issue for you at all?
Not very much. I've been keeping myself out of danger, and I have a gentleman right here with 3 dogs, so nobody's really
looking dogs.
They're little Boston Terriers. They're great. The one in the black harness, his name is Little Wolf. And the one in the gray harness, on the other side of the gentleman, is Esker. And the third dog is actually the first, and she's the mom in the green harness, and her name is Tova.
Now, have you all been driving up by bike or walking up? Or
we've been riding our bikes up. We went up Coast Highway, and all those stores up in that on that highway, those little places where all those stores were, ate us up.
Really?
they were real expensive.
Well, in other words, they didn't. They ate you up rather than giving you food to eat.
Yeah, they ate me up. We bought food and whatnot from them, but they ate us up. We couldn't buy any more food after that. We had to come up. We got stuck here for a little bit, and then we're gonna go. We're gonna get immunizations for our 2 young adults there.
Adult pooches.
Yeah, adult pooches. Adult dog immunizations. Yeah, and then we're gonna just continue heading north, I guess. One of our stops will be San Francisco. I call this place Canna Screws because there's some crazy characters out here.
People smoking marijuana here?
Not too much, but there's like certain areas where they don't really approve of it. They'll come around and say, well, I don't approve of you smoking pot in this area. You know, like say over by those four train tracks over there.
The response is, I don't approve of you showing your disapproval to me.
Well, I think that, but I don't say that because I don't like to get into arguments with people. I try to be as non-combative as I can be, but I might turn into a real combative person after going to San Francisco. I don't know.
So do you have a condition that requires you or that makes it easier, better if you use medical marijuana?
Yeah, actually I do.
You don't have to say what it is, but you can if you want.
It's called Tourette's.
Huh. You don't seem to be Tourette-ing too much at the moment.
No, mostly it's having to do with environment. If it's real stressful, I get these really bad nervous tics. And also,
what do you do? Just smoke marijuana? What else do you do to relieve that?
I don't know, exercise, go walk the dogs, vent at the trees, whatever, just
get a hug, perhaps.
Get a hug, yeah, that helps.
Do your fellow who's tending, your associate who's tending the dog?
He's originally from Monterey.
What's your name, sir?
His name is David.
David. And David, how long have you been on the road, should I say? Or are you a man on the road or just temporarily on the road?
Well, temporarily on the road, almost forever.
And we've been traveling on and off for a while, but we're going to be moving indoors up north.
Almost forever.
And did you two meet in Santa Barbara?
We met Santa Barbara 15 years ago.
Wow. So you guys have been together for quite a while.
15 years.
This is a monogamous relationship, I suppose. So much of my scheming to jump into the scene here.
Oh, yeah. Just being able to come up and visit new places where I haven't been. But he was here decades ago when he was a young man.
So how has this changed from when you were much younger and up to?
Well, when I was here younger, you had fishermen along the banks, sitting down there fishing right up to the shore.
What year or what decade was it?
Well, that was real early 60s. But the big change is I think that it's right to sit and try to protect the riverbanks and stuff from pollution, so that we can get a thriving river the homeless, we need fair rules to live by so that we can live as citizens side by side.
Now, are you thinking
that's really all I want to say.
Okay. No comparison with Santa Barbara, particularly.
Santa Barbara?
Yeah.
No, Santa Barbara, when it comes to homelessness?
And how homeless people are treated.
Well, homeless people are treated badly everywhere. They're not given their citizenship.
It's even worse than Santa Barbara, believe it or not. They actually try to shut off as many services as possible to try to drive people away.
Well, it's not so much the services.
Criminalization in terms of forbidden zones and sleeping bans, things of that sort, perhaps?
Yeah.
In constitutional law, it says that sometimes a municipality has to make laws that will protect the rights of somebody else and restrict somebody else's rights in order to protect somebody else's. Whenever a municipality does that, they must do it in the most narrowest possible way so as not to trample over the rights of one individual over another. So that you don't, now making it against the law to sleep anywhere is just craziness. What we need is some fair rules to live by, places where people can sleep, so that we don't destroy the environment. Sit down and we work together, get some toilets. Let's get real. Stop this thing.
But we don't want your kind around here.
We're citizens. We're here forever.
Thank you. And we've been talking with
Dave.
And with
Dina.
Thank you, Dina. Thank you, Dave.
That's the attitudes of whole cities and whole societies. It needs to change. But at the same same time, they need to make it easier for us to get work and not block us. They block a lot of people who want to work.
Whatever, please.
I'll let you go. Thank you. What's your name?
Dawn.
And Dawn, how long have you been in Santa Cruz?
For the summer.
And how is it treating you?
It's been kind of nice, actually. It could be better, but it's been all right.
Are you indoors or outdoors?
Both.
And how are you treated outdoors? Are you getting ticketed or hassled?
I did get one ticket for camping where I was not supposed to.
Bad girl.
Yes, it was naughty. But I will tell the public, if you do have your name on a wait list and you're trying to look for housing, that the ticket can be
evaporated, disintegrated, going to the memory
eliminated.
And there was a little discussion about this last show with Steve Plaich, a homeless person's legal assistance project. He notes that the Paul Lee Loft is going to be taken over by a bunch of people moving from the six-month program in the Page Smith Community House, which is another program in the same homeless lack of service center area, which will mean there'll be no 30-day program anymore, only this much longer-term program. And he is supposed to be finding out if the waiting list will still exist. The importance of this waiting list, as you just heard Don say, is that if you're on the waiting list, according to the 2010 law, not the 29 law, as was falsely reported in the Good Times today by a writer writing about the smashing of the homeless camps, a rather bad article that just goes through all kinds of police nonsense and kind of puffs up what they're doing, and then gives Don Lane a pat on the back as well, the mayor. There will be there's a situation where people should not be getting tickets at all, but that protection for homeless people may not be available. And Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, I hopefully is going to look into that. I've been trying to organize some folks to check it out, and maybe we will. And if you want to be a part of the attempt to monitor and prevent police abuse and abuse of homeless people for these life-sustaining survival activities that don't hurt anyone but that are criminalized anyway, give a call to 423-HUFF,
423-4833. I would like some cream cheese.
He's getting a bagel and cream cheese.
Otherwise, it's been nice. I've enjoyed having the beach and the redwoods and the hiking trails.
Where are you from?
But it's in Orange County, where we don't have a whole lot of trees.
Are you alone or in company?
So, right now, yeah, I'm kind of solo. So doing a solo pilgrimage.
Some attractive babe. How has this affected you?
It's kind of boring that my counterpart, my other half, doesn't join me on my pilgrimages.
Have you met any other available individuals?
Yeah, there's tons of hot guys in Santa Cruz, for sure. There are lots of beautiful people everywhere.
Are they treating you right?
Yeah, you know what? I have to say, for the most part, yeah.
A man in line says,
when tourists come into Santa Cruz, what's the first thing that we want them to see?
Right here?
And my answer is Robert Norse.
Of course, I'm the one. We for sure.
Go see him with any problems that you have, and he'll tell you what's really going in Santa Cruz, and then you'll see what's really going on.
I am the source of all truth.
No comment.
Thank you. Two opinions. Any comments for Free Radio?
No
comments. Hey, Ugly Jim, any comments?
No.
Is that again?
Santa Cruz is boring. I'm out of here.
Thank you. Ugly Jim is saying goodbye. So you're leaving on the... How long have you been in Santa Cruz now?
10 years. 10 years.
And you've been a man who works a lot on vehicles.
Yeah.
And you're going to Santa Rosa.
Yeah, just to get out of Santa Cruz, because every time you turn around, the cops are harassing you. They give you tickets for scavenging when you're recycling. Everything you do, they're on you for something. Nobody wants us here, so I may as well leave. Where are we supposed to go, though? We're not going to vaporize. We've got to go somewhere. You know, in general, homeless people in general have to go somewhere. We're not just going to beam up and disappear.
So you've chosen Santa Rosa as an escape hatch?
Yes. Yeah. I love Santa Cruz. I just don't love the politics, the people, you know. The area is beautiful. It's perfect. But it helps if you're a millionaire, too. And you're cool with Santa Cruz as long as you agree with everything they go with. If you disagree or live differently, then you're out, you know. Then they don't like you, so I'm gone.
Well, can you give us a report from Santa Rosa if you think of it? Here's the free radio number. You can tell us.
Can I pick you up there?
Sorry?
Can I pick you up there?
You can catch us on the stream if you go to computer.
Okay,
you
know, thank you.
But not FM. But,
all right, thank you, buddy.
Yeah. Okay, well, it is
August 1st, 2012. We're on the, it's the end of an Occupy Santa Cruz Wednesday meeting, and it's around 6:35, and I'm talking with...
I'd rather not say.
An anonymous source, a source. And you have a rather disturbing report.
Yes, today I witnessed four uniformed Santa Cruz City Police officers in Santa Cruz County giving campers the verbal bums rush.
And where was this in the county?
It was north of Redwood Creek. You can find that on any map of the Poganip, pretty much. It was north of Redwood Creek and east of the Poganip line.
And how many campers were involved?
I didn't see any other people there. I just saw the four uniformed peace officers who were clearly in Santa Cruz County.
And did you catch the identities of any of them?
No, but I could probably pick one of them out. He was a Hispanic with a brush cut. He was the only one of the four who wasn't wearing wearing headgear.
How close were you to this action?
I was about 30 feet.
And what time of day was it?
It was approximately 5 o'clock this afternoon.
So it just happened about 2 hours ago.
That's about right.
Did you hear any conversation or any words from them?
They asked me where I was going. I said here, and I spread my arms out, indicating where I was.
Right.
And they said, do you camp here? I said, sometimes. They said, well, camping is illegal. You got to move on.
So that seemed to be their primary purpose had to do with clearing out people who either were camping or intending to camp?
That appeared to be the case, yes.
Did they have anything with them, like were they carrying tents, detritus, tasers, a machine gun?
No, they're just the usual uniform gear.
And did they have any literature with them of any kind, except they would be posted?
None that I saw. They just gave me, the verbal bums rush, and I went in another direction.
So most of the Poganip, you know, is within the city limits. In fact, I think all the Poganip is within the city limits. But you say this is beyond the Poganip?
I can guarantee it. I can show the spot, and I'm prepared to testify in court. Not that it'll do anybody any good.
I hear you. No. I just know that, you know, the city acquired the Poganip and incorporated that area like 15 years ago or some such thing, or maybe 20 years ago. So, have you been camping up there yourself?
Yeah, Ogden County, yes.
And how has that been? How have you been treated by sheriffs and by other police officers?
I almost never see them.
And how long have you been doing this for?
Oh, more than a decade.
And you're one of the light campers on the land, not a messy camper.
I try not to be. I take out a lot of other people's trash.
So have you noticed an upsurge of this kind of... we know that, of course, police harassment downtown has significantly increased, and particularly for around camping, but have you noticed it out there?
Recently, there's been an upswing, but there's been an increase in the amount of druggies who can't maintain out there, too, I hate to say.
Any general thoughts about Santa Cruz Police and Sheriff treatment of campers?
Well, I work so hard at avoiding all of them, I don't have enough experience to give an opinion, except that my most noteworthy opinion would be with regard to campers who don't maintain, who do use drugs, and who create a hassle for everybody else. But that does not excuse the flagrant violation of jurisdiction by the Santa Cruz Police Department.
I appreciate you keep these reports coming in. I think they're important. We can call you perhaps Shoelaces. I'm trying to think of a name for you. A milkman, perhaps? You're sipping some milk.
Maybe. That'll do.
All right, milkman. Thank you for your update. And any final thoughts?
No, it's just, but if it's going to be like this, everybody's going to be in trouble. And I think there needs to be some kind of show of at least... people have to put their foot down and say, if you're going to represent the law, you have to follow the law.
One can't disagree with you. The question is, who's going to lead the charge, milkman?
Who knows? Who knows?
Who indeed? Thank you.
So it's after the Occupy Senate.
I'm down here at, I don't know, New Leaf Corner, talking with a gang of ne'er-do-wells. Of course, the notorious Rico is always here eating seaweed.
Well, we're bringing in the new generation of street musicians. Suzanne's daughter is down here playing. We have a whole new generation.
Before they leave, Suzanne, introduce your daughter to Free Radio.
Ah, this is my daughter, Katrina Winchell.
Hey, Katrina.
Beautiful.
Hey, I'm Kat.
Yeah.
What do you play, Katrina?
I play guitar and I sing.
Have you gotten your introductory ticket from the police department yet?
Oh, no, thankfully, but I'm looking forward to my grand debut.
You know, we're sure that, you know, one of the officers, Preps Officer Winston, will be by to help out with that.
As long as you don't say his name three times in a row, usually he doesn't show up too often.
Has there been much police harassment lately?
We just got back from Montana, so we haven't really been out. It's our first night out.
Montana, oh-ho. So you think you're now you're okay. Well, this isn't Montana, sweetheart.
Oh, no, it's not. In fact, in Montana, they had a festival, a folk festival, and I watched a guy hand the cop a beer and asked him, you know, hold it while he tied his shoe, and he did. Yeah, crazy.
Well, I will say no more. Welcome back, Suzanne. How long have you been gone?
About 3 weeks.
And, well, how does it look to you?
You know, I've been hearing some stories that you might want to go down by the beach area and talk to people because they've been saying that they've been getting beat up by the cops. You know, I asked them if they had, you know, been drinking or been sassing the cops, because sometimes, you know, you give them reason to it. You know, there's different stories, but they're definitely really, I don't know, very excited about it, where, you know, like, it's, they feel like their rights have been violated. Honey is one of them.
Is she here on the street?
On the beach, yeah, on the beachfront. She hangs out there on there.
Now, have you ever been to the Cafe Gratitude and had their kind of donate meal? You know about that?
Mm-mm. No, I don't.
Cafe Gratitude is the cafe over there, which has a visitor's bathroom, which everybody is allowed to use, supposedly, as well as the Pizza My Heart and Bookshop Coonerty, which people are allowed to use, supposedly. When this one is gets a little grubby, you might want to check out the nice bed. But supposedly, if you give them any amount of money, they'll give you a certain kind of food. Just a penny even will buy a small amount of food. So,
and there is a free kind of, I don't know, it's a rice and beans plate, but it's a very modest bowl of food. I'm not very modest. I've never had it. I've heard, however, that it's there. Went into the Cafe Gratitude, which is right down Lincoln Street, right off of Pacific Avenue, and that's where you can get a bite to eat. Donate as much as you want or as little as you want, I believe, then you get this bowl. And there's also a visitor's bathroom, so that you don't have to be a customer, you don't have to, you know, be fashion sensitive or wear your... whatever, you could just go in and use the bathroom. Visitors,
you have to wear whatever.
Uncle Dennis here is here, as you may have heard, in case you were wondering what that scuffling around in the background is. But anyway, visitors' bathrooms are available in three different places for those who haven't been expelled from the businesses, as I have, for instance. The Bookshop Coonerty, also known as the Bookshop Santa Cruz, Pizza My Heart, and, of course, the Cafe Gratitude. Those actually have little signs, so it's public money that actually funds these bathrooms.
Right, to the letting homeless people use
them. Uncle Dennis will give you a full analysis of all this shit, so to speak. And he'll also, of course, be...
You gotta get rid of shit. There's places to do it.
There would be nice if there were more places, particularly late at night, when there are really no places for those who aren't...
Well, you can just shit where all the homeless people shit.
There you have it. The new approach that Uncle Dennis will describe in more detail when he goes through some of his shit in the upcoming show. That's about it for my show.
You get your shit out of here, Robert?
I got a couple minutes left, and I'm resisting the clumsy colloquy here with Uncle Dennis.
Actually, if I set the clock correctly, you have 2 seconds.
Actually, you didn't. Yeah, that looks like 40 seconds, Uncle Dennis. Yeah. Now, you actually have to, I'll claim an extra minute and a half, as I would say at City Council, because of these interruptions.
Why don't you come back on Sunday, then?
I will be coming back on Sunday.
Get your shit out of here.
And in the meantime, I want you to give a call to the Huff line, 423-HUFF, if you see any of the kinds of incidents you've heard being described on the air tonight. Harassment, people being told to leave without being given any alternatives. Again, the police state kind of stuff that unfortunately is becoming more and more prevalent, but that... That we indeed do pay for. There's a number of events coming up. The Mime Troupe will be here this Saturday at 2 o'clock. Uncle Dennis will have a chance to fulminate freely when he hits the mic, which is going to be very, It's going to be very shortly. But again, Mime Troupe will be here on Saturday and Sunday, and the supporters for the Santa Cruz 11 will also be flyering and doing skits and encouraging you to just say no to DA Bobley, and more important, to say no to the police repression, which these prosecutions really represent. They have nothing to do with any legitimate law enforcement, as much of the police harassment of homeless similarly has little to do with anything that involves legitimate crime. Dennis here will give you more details during his show. Thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathroom Spears Broadsides. If you want to see it, or rather hear it archived, you can go to the Huff website, huffsantacruz.org, and click on the name of the show, Bathroom Spears Broadsides. My broadsides are leaving the studio shortly, and Dennis's broadsides will be here for the next 3 hours, so stay tuned.